Welcome to Executives After Hours, real conversations with real leaders. This is your host, Dr. James Kelly. I want to make you a promise that over the next 60 minutes, you will learn at a minimum two things. One, every leader and executive makes mistakes on the way to the top. And two, and more importantly, everyone has a unique story to tell. And that's what we do here on Executive After Hours. We sit down with leaders across a variety of industries, and we talk to them about their unique story. So welcome to the community, and stay tuned for today's episode on your Executives After Hours.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Executives After Hours. This is your host, me, Dr. James Kelly. Today on the show, I had the pleasure to interview Miss JJ Virgin. She's actually married again after we did this recording. JJ is a multiple-time New York Times best-selling author for the books like The Virgin Diet, The Virgin Diet Cookbook, JJ Virgin Sugar Impact Diet, and her newest book is The Miracle Mindset. JJ's been on Dr. Phil. She had her own show on TLC called Freaky Eater. Been on PBS, Dr. Oz, Rachel Ray, Today's Show. So JJ is quite proficient in the media realm. And more importantly, she is really awesome, super open and transparent. We talk about her adoption as a child. We talk about, you know, going to UCLA and just her journey and her son who got in a horrific car accident, you know, right as she was launching her last book. So have a listen. Remember, go to the website, drjameskelly.com, to get the full length interview and get all the other tidbits you're not getting in the short one here as well. I chop and change up the interview so you kind of get the best of the best. So anyhow, and also go to the website, partake in this idea of sharing your crucible. It's a project I have going on that I'd like to launch December, January. So go to our website, submit your story, and be part of the process of the Crucible's gift coming out. All right, I want to say thanks to Sweet Sweet Radio. Everyone have a nice week. See you. All right, today on this episode, which, by the way, I got to say, I was doing some digging and diving on you, and I'll give the
Uh-oh.
Big... And I'm really excited to have JJ Virgin on my show today. So thank you for coming on Executives After Hours.
Well, now I'm afraid.
No need to be afraid. petrified, perhaps, but afraid,
okay.
No. Yeah. And just, you know, my audience doesn't necessarily may or may not know this, but you've written five bestseller books, not even like just five books, but you've written The Virgin Diet, The Sugar Impact Diet, The 6 Weeks to Sleeveless and Sexy, The Zero Tolerance Diet. And the one that's actually most intriguing, I mean, they're all intriguing to me, and I can love to talk about sugar because it's one of my crack cocaines, is, you know, basically The Miracle Mindset, you know. And that one, just even by the look of the cover, has this more personal feel about it. And so before we start diving down this path about why sugar is evil, and I agree it's evil, but it's addicting. My wife's a triathlon coach, and she reads a ton, and we both always say, if we could just give up sugar, if we could just give it up, you know, it'd be
all right.
So
maybe
much
we
better.
Should just get this done today then.
Yeah. And I would be game. Believe me, I'd be game. I work so hard not to have it. But before you convince me that sugar is the evil being, which you don't have to do much convincing, where are you originally from?
I'm from Berkeley, California.
So born and raised?
I grew up in the 60s in Berkeley.
what was that like?
It was super cool. Like, how lucky was I? I mean, I grew up in a place that is as, what's the word when you don't see different colors and races and religions? And I mean, it was such a
tolerance?
Mix of everybody. Yeah, I mean, it just was like, this was just normal. My high school was everybody and everything, and you didn't think anything of it. I actually had never been confronted with like real true, you know, issues with prejudice until I moved to LA and went to UCLA. And And then I moved to the South, which was a nightmare, a nightmare. I had no idea that people still behave this way. But I moved to Florida, which was not like that a little bit. But then I moved to North Carolina, which was like unbelievable.
You grew up in the 60s in Berkeley, which has to be fascinating from a cultural revolution standpoint. But what were your parents doing there?
So it's funny because my parents are not like that at all. I mean, my mom's from the Midwest and my dad's family came over from Sweden. So super, they're pretty conservative. It honestly, it's like living with the Cleavers. But, you know, you just think it's normal. I grew up in Berkeley. I went to acting school in San Francisco. So I had like a super cool, you know, upbringing, getting exposed to a lot of stuff. But that's what you think is normal. Mm-hmm. Like it. To me, it was just a completely usual thing to do.
But were your parents in your ear like, oh, those hippies, or like, were they trying to bias your opinion, or were they super cool parents who were kind of, you're going to sort it out?
No, they were super, like, my parents kind of are golfing cocktail people.
what a great description.
I'm not a golfing cocktail person. So. Yeah, okay, So, I mean, they actually didn't really... My biggest takeaway from my parents is you were supposed to go to college and get married. And then you weren't supposed to work. Your husband was supposed to work and he was supposed to have a job with really great health insurance and benefits.
Very old school.
Very old school. Yeah. And I kept looking at my mom's life. And I think people, you know, there's two types of role models, right? And it was the role model of, it was what she wanted, but it was, God, it was, to me, I looked like it was complete prison. I thought, this is the last thing on earth I want to do. Like, this is horrible. And I literally, from the time I was little, like, I started working. I remember I started, like, my first little job around the neighborhood. I was going to clean houses and walk dogs and do dance shows, you know, whatever I could do to make money. Not those kind of dance shows, tap dancing.
I wasn't going
just
there.
Just for full disclosure. Okay, just for anyone whose little dirty mind went there, shame on you. I was a kid. But, you know, I just kind of went, okay, this is not what I want. And so I'm going to have to work for what I do want. And I paid my way through American Conservatory Theater Acting School. I got a scholarship to college because I was like, I'll just get a scholarship so I can do what I want. And always had lots of jobs, and a lot of them I created myself. so I can get the heck out of there.
But where does that come from? Like, right, this sense of entrepreneurship is actually quite an interesting aspect, because your mom wasn't necessarily that role model.
I find my birth parents. My birth dad is a massive entrepreneur, and my birth mom and her whole family are scientists, like NASA physicists, pharmacists, biologists, you know. And I was like, oh, no wonder. And it's so interesting, you know, the whole nature versus nurture.
Yeah.
I meet these people. I walk up a plane. I look at a woman who looks just like me, is dressed like me, has the same likes and interests as me. I am nothing like my adopted parents. Like nothing. I mean, nothing at all. In fact, there was all this, you know, they're amazing people. I so appreciate everything they've done for me. And don't get me wrong on that. But just from a pure, like, how I roll, I'm my genes, you know? It's kind of interesting.
So why did your parents put you up for adoption?
Because they were engaged to be married, and she got pregnant, and it was not the right time per him, not the right time, right? And so he wanted her to abort, and and this is in the 60s, he wanted her to drink quinine to abort, so she, like, hit the road, which I think, what a badass, right?
Yeah.
So she hits the road. She moves to San Francisco from Eugene, Oregon. They were, by the way, in their final year of college. This is the first man she has sex with. It's like the second or third time. And they're engaged to be married. And so they're engaged to be married. She goes off to San Francisco, moves into an unwed home, a home for unwed mothers, this Catholic home for unwed mothers. And, I mean, the whole thing is amazing to me that she did this. And has me. And she was very clear when she was giving me up for adoption that she wanted to give me up to a family that, you know, cared about education and athletics.
What was it like when you reconnected with your biological parents? And I'm curious, the reason why I'm curious about this is I have two nephews who were my brother adopted, whose mom and dad were drug addicts, who I believe have actually both passed away, but they have a pretty big extended family. And I just psychologically wonder what that's like when you get into the room and the questions you must have and all of that.
Yeah, I had so many questions. And the question was, what does it feel like when I met them? Wait, I like just was listening to you went sideways.
No, I have no actual linear thoughts. So just describe to me.
Couple that with my ADD and we're off to races. This will be awesome.
I'm going to be talking about Jupiter soon. You'll be talking about Saturn and we'll figure out how it works. No, I was just kind of talking about how that moment when you met them and the questions that you had and kind of the psychological just mind melt that might have been.
Yeah, it's been a very weird journey. I've had to do a lot of processing on, and I think it's important for people who are adopting kids to really understand what they're doing when they do it. Because there's a really great book called Primal Wound that talks about what it feels like to be an adopted kid. And your parents can tell you, hey, you were more loved because your parents had to really, you know, want you, keep you and put you up for adoption, find the right place. And we had to fight for you. And they can say all they want. But the bottom line is you're a kid who the very person who's supposed to love you, you know, unconditionally gave you up. And so it's they call it this primal wound. And no matter what anybody says, you still feel like, and I've heard this from so many adopted kids, like I've talked to so many adoptees, we tend to find each other. That they feel abandoned and they always are wondering if they're going to get dumped again by their, you know, adopted parents. It's a very real thing. And so it's really important for adopted parents to be super open about the whole thing, be super open to any relationship they might want to have. I was lucky in sort of in that I had a pretty good experience finding my birth parents, not awesome. And I'll talk about it, but, better than some.
I mean, strength, like, have you always had this sense of strength and reserve and I don't know if the word moral compass, but at least like this compass of justice for yourself. I mean, is that something you always had or something you developed over the years?
I think I've always had it and it's just gotten a lot stronger. In fact, it's funny because my adopted mom does not have this at all. And I remember like even something as simple as you order something at a restaurant and they bring you something that isn't really what you ordered and you send it back. Right. And she's like, don't do that. Don't make waves. I'm like, what? You know, like, of course I am. I'm going to go fight for what I asked for. Like, come on, you know? So, but I also think, you know, resilience, grit, tenacity, the more you use them, the more they increase. Yeah. So,
well,
right.
The more you believe in them. That's the thing, right? Like
I think the more you do them, the more you believe in them, then the more, you know, it's always these catch 22. Like if you want to get a job, you need to have work experience. Right. Yeah. So if you believe you're tenacious, then you do something because you're tenacious, then you feel, oh, I'm tenacious. Then you do more, you know, it's like, you know how these things go.
Yeah. As you go to UCLA, you do some acting, you say acting sucks and you go into nutrition.
Well, I didn't say acting sucked. I loved it, but I hated
the
department there.
Sorry, the acting school sucked. Sorry, correct.
The acting school. I mean, I went to one of the top acting schools and my parents, this is kind of crazy. Here I am. I've got a scholarship to anywhere. All right. I got a scholarship. I didn't just get any scholarship. I got a scholarship where I could go to any school in the United States, full ride. And they said, no, you can't leave California. And I'm like, well, I'm going to get as far away from Northern California to then, you know? So I fell in love with UCLA, went there. Great school. But the acting department was not like the acting department at home. And truthfully, I started taking classes. And what's ridiculous is I took engineering and math and didn't miss anything, like got the highest grades in the class. And then I took this English class and I got insulted by the professor. He basically read my story and said how stupid it was. And I thought, okay, you know what? F you. I'm going to show you. And so I became an English major. This was stupid. I should have just done math. You know, it's like I was actually, you know, High school, I was number five in the state in math. I just disregarded, and I think we do this. This is a bigger lesson, yeah, that when things are too easy for you, you just tend to discount it. And so I was like, oh, this is too easy. You know, it was just like, it wasn't even a challenge. And one of my sons is the same way. He's just like, math is his jam. So now I've told him, hey, just go after math. Okay. You know?
Well, and now for kids, math can be coding. Math can be all sorts of different fun things.
Oh my God. Math is everything. It's everything. Like, you got math, you got everything. So, you know, but it didn't hurt. It's in retrospect, it was not a bad thing to learn how to write. So, you know, it doesn't ever hurt you to know how to write better. And then I took scientific writing, but along the way in college, I took a class, a nutrition class, and I went, I was taking exercise. First, I started taking exercise class. Then I started taking a nutrition class. And then literally the day after I graduated, I started in grad school in exercise science, because in college, I started taking aerobics classes, and I'd been a dance teacher in high school. It's one of the ways I paid my way through high school. And then I went to UCLA and I started taking aerobics classes at a little place in LA. And then they sent me to Japan to teach aerobics. And so
I love the Japanese. You
know, I do too. It was harder to leave there. Like, I had worse culture shock coming home when I left there, because I moved from there into a sorority house. It was absolutely horrendous. It was like a terrible situation.
Yeah, I don't feel like you'd be a sorority individual.
You know, I was in a really good sorority for a non-sorority girl to be in.
All right.
It was kind of like the rebel sorority house.
I feel like you're saying it's really good to be under 5'2" for people who are 5'1". That's what it sounds like to me. sorry, I didn't interrupt you. So I'm just trying to figure out how you got into nutrition, which is obviously the grad school thing, right?
Well, I started in exercise science, and I actually went to Cal State Northridge. Then I went over to University of Miami following a guy and did sports nutrition. I did sports medicine there. And then I came back to SC and went into their doctoral program. And in their doctoral program, I took a nutrition class, because I ran out of exercise classes. There were just like, you know, I'd taken everything possible that you could take. And neurophys and all sorts of cool stuff, but I was out of classes.
Was there something about that really intrigued you?
I've always loved nutrition and movement. I just never thought, back at the time, I knew I didn't want to be a dietitian and teach people how to eat wrong. So no offense, but anyone who's a dietitian who's not doing more of the functional stuff, it's horrific what the education is. It's just awful. Anyway, I knew I didn't want to do that. So then I found out that you can actually study nutrition without having to become a dietitian. So I just fell in love with it. I don't like organic chemistry and inorganic chemistry, but biochemistry is really fascinating, and hormones and endocrinology. So that was my next leap. I actually dropped out of doctoral school and started switching over to different grad schools to take more nutrition stuff.
So you're basically like a lifelong learner.
Well, aren't we all? Like, if you're not learning, then what's happening? Well, I would hope we all should be lifelong learners.
That
my
part
gosh.
Is true.
I mean, I'm always amazed when people say they're bored, because there's so many cool things that I would love to study. You know, like I just, if someone asked me right now, I'm getting ready to get married, and people are like, what do you want? And I'm like, time. Just give me some time. That's all I want.
So how did you, JJ, start getting into this though? Like, after you finish this and you've exceeded the maximum time, years, and limits to take exercise science and nutrition classes, and they said, JJ, go get a job. Like, what did you end up doing?
Oh, I was always working the whole time.
Well, I'm sure you were.
I mean,
sorry.
I've paid for every single, like, no one's paid for anything I've done.
I didn't mean to imply that, sorry. Like, you're totally a hard worker, so I wasn't trying to imply that.
Even at UCLA, I had five jobs at one point when I was in there as an undergrad, even though I had a scholarship, just because I wanted to see what I really liked to do. And then all the way through grad school, I was doing exercise. I was a personal trainer. It was me and Body by Jake. We were actually the first two personal trainers that I know of in the country. And here's the interesting thing with that. I'm like looking at this dude who's got, like, here I have all of this education and training, right? Everyone else who's in school with me is going off to be a professor, and I'm sitting here doing personal training. And Jake is working 30-minute sessions. He's got his brother doing it too. They're doing what seems to me asinine stuff, not founded in science, and they're charging twice as much as me, and they've got a waiting list. And I thought, okay, clearly I need to learn something here. And I kept thinking, but I know more. And I realized that doesn't matter. Yeah. They market. And it was such a good lesson for me because I went, you know, they market better. I need to learn marketing. And that's when I went through and started raising my rates. I totally changed my process of how I went and got clients. And I had a waiting list and a six-figure cash business in the early 80s when I was in college. But then all of a sudden I was looking around because all of a sudden more and more people are becoming personal trainers, and it's a total grind. Like, you start at 5:30 in the morning. I mean, some of them are starting at 4:30. I'm like, no way. Yeah. And, you know, it's my last one would be at 9 at night. I'd work on the weekends. And I thought, A, I don't want to be 50 counting and telling people what to do. And B, what really happened was one of my clients was a Hawaiian Blue Diamond in Nu Skin. And she started talking to me about leverage, scaling, and duplication. And I was looking, and so I started hiring personal trainers to work for me, but it's you can't really duplicate yourself. So, you know, if you hire someone good, they're going to go build their own business. And so I was very interested in how I could create a real business, because being a personal trainer is not having a business, it's having a job and a bad boss. So that she actually, you know, I kept thinking the way to get more successful is to get more education. And she was like, well, not really. And I actually sold my personal training business and moved into her house. And she became my Mr. Miyagi for 6 months. And she was going to teach me how to create duplication, leverage, and scale. And the first couple months, she didn't teach me a thing. All she did was help me work on my mindset.
Huh.
Yeah. Starting with wearing a rubber band around my wrist. And every time I thought something negative or limiting or said something negative or read something negative, I had to snap myself, which meant, like, you know, the first couple of days was like, you know, total red wrist. I thought I was not getting any skin left. But, you know, she taught me really how to realize that there, you know, she was like, there is no right or wrong. There just is. I'm like, of course there's right and wrong. She's like, the only limitations are in your mind. I'm like, of course there's limitations. You know, I mean, it was such a mind shift for me, and that really laid the foundation for everything that I've done.
Can you remember when you got it?
It wasn't like one day I woke up and got it. It was just this transformation where all of a sudden you look back and you realize you don't even think that way anymore, that I don't spend my time around negative people with limiting beliefs. I can spot them, and it's like, you know, I'm out.
So, yeah, I'm looking at your years of, like, your books, right? And so your first book, if I have the chronological order right, it's 2010. Is that right? Roughly?
Yeah, that sounds about right. Was that the 6 weeks of Sleeveless and Sexy?
Correct.
Yeah.
So I guess, you know, I mean, cause we could obviously go year by year, minute by minute. We'd be here for 48 hours or so, maybe. But what I really want to know more about then is the path that got you to write this first book.
So what happened with that is I was sitting at a business, I started hiring coaches, which is one of the most, it was really when my career really went from small to big, was I hired a mentor and I joined a mastermind. Mm-hmm. And I was at the group, and everybody was asking me about my arms all the time. It was like, how'd you get those arms? How'd you get those arms? And I was getting, frankly, irritated with the whole thing. And then all of a sudden it was like someone, you know, it was a moonstruck moment. I got slapped in the face with, dummy, why don't you just create a program? Because we were all doing online programs. I go, I'll create an online program, 6 weeks of Sleeveless and Sexy. And I had a manager at the time. I'd just gotten off of 2 years on Dr. Phil. I had a manager and I told him what I was going to create. He goes, that's a book. And the next thing I know, he's got a proposal writer over my hotel room. She writes the proposal. The next week, I've been going to New York to do some magazine sit-downs. And he had me meet with publishers. And I sat down to lunch with this first publisher. She'd had the proposal. I took off my jacket. I was wearing a sleeveless top. And she goes, I want the book. And so that was it. I didn't understand anything at the time. I was so excited. I got a $50,000 advance. I remember walking through the streets of New York. No, nothing. She just said, I want the book. And I said, okay, you know, which is not how you do this.
Yeah.
And, you know, my manager sucked. But I remember walking through the streets of New York thinking, I made it. Not knowing that was a really bad decision, right? That, you know, it's like, it's going to cost more to do everything I would need to do for the book than to do the book. So, but it was a place to start. And what I realized after doing that first book was that if I was going to ever do a book again, I was going to learn how to market it, just like with personal training.
Yeah.
And so the next thing that happened was that same mentor was like, you got to get back on TV. Cause I'd been on Dr. Phil for a couple of years. Then I got this ABC primetime pilot, spent months taping it. And then the thing never went and it took me off of Dr. Phil. And it kind of, I had a year of, I couldn't be on TV and I just went, screw this. This is stupid. And she goes, you need to be back on TV. And I said, all right. And so I literally kind of I do a lot of manifesting intention. And I was like, okay, I got to get back on TV. Get a call from the guy who booked me on ABC, calling me up, going, I got an audition for you. Literally the next week. I'm like, okay. So that's when I got on TLC's Freaky Eaters. And what was great about that show was not the show itself. That was, could have made me crazy because you literally were all over the country for weeks doing this. We were in like Reading, Pennsylvania in January, trudging through the snow following popsicle sticks. I'm like, I went to college. Like, what am I doing here? but the co-star had an amazing agent, a literary agent, and she had gotten him $500,000 for his book. And I'm thinking, dude, you don't have half the platform that I have. And she did that for you. I'm going to go, I was like, introduce me. And I met with her and she was like, you need to do something around food intolerance, which is one of the things I talked about in terms of weight loss resistance. She goes, this is the book. And so I was like, all right, I'm very coachable. And I think that's an important element of success is being coachable. I had been talking about weight loss resistance and all these things that get in the way of you losing weight and cause you to gain weight for years. I wanted to write a book on that. She goes, no, just write it on food intolerance. And at the time, no one was calling it food intolerance. They thought it was food allergies. It's not. And so I said, all right. Well, we went out. I said, I want a $500,000 advance. And so I go out with her. We're going to sell this book. My show gets canceled. My first book, like maybe sold 2,000 copies. And now we're going to go get a $500,000 advance. And we did it, which is just because she's amazing. And I'd also figured out a lot of different ways to market and sell things by that point. So I then hired Brendan Burchard because I was like, if I'm going to do this book, I'm going to do it right. He was the one I saw that was really doing books well at the time. And coached with him. He was fantastic. And the most amazing part of that whole Virgin Diet, because after that came Virgin Diet Cookbook, Sugar Impact Diet, Sugar Impact Diet Cookbook, Miracle Mindset. But that book, literally a couple weeks before it was all coming out, and I was doing a PBS show with it, I literally took the whole $500,000 advance and then some, and I put it towards marketing, which is what I feel we should do with it. To me, advances are marketing money.
Yeah.
And so that's what I did. And a couple weeks before, and I have everything invested in it. I am the financial support for my family. I'm it. I've got teenage boys, 15 and 16. And literally weeks before this happens, my 16-year-old son gets hit by a car when crossing the street. And I had to launch that book bedside with him in a coma.
Yeah.
Crazy story. Like still to this day, it's like people go, how'd you do that? I'm like, you know, I just had to do it. Didn't have a choice.
So can I ask you a quick question? Cause I want to talk about this. I think this is obviously one of your major crucibles of your life. I mean, you've had many by all means, being adopted, doing things on your own. But the only gap that I really have that if you can close just quickly for me mentally is how did you get on Dr. Phil's show? Like, how did you get to that point?
So I was really putting out there into the universe that I wanted to, you know, one of the challenges of being a personal trainer is you only impact a couple people.
Yeah.
And what was cool was at least I was impacting their families, but it was frustrating. And so I started doing public speaking and I thought, well, this is great. And, you know, this is helpful. And then I moved to Palm Springs and I thought, all right, I need to build my business up quickly. And I've been doing a lot of public speaking, but I thought, you know, I think I'll start doing TV, and local TV is easy to get on. So I started doing local TV And one of the things that I also started doing was coaching doctors on how to put nutrition in their practice. And so I was at a functional medicine event, and a doctor came up to me and he goes, you know, I know you've been coaching doctors, and I'd love some help because I'm going to be the Dr. Phil doctor for his weight loss challenges. And I went, all right, you know, let me, you know, whatever you need. So he had me come in when Dr. Phil was launching his weight loss challenge and help him. Well, I'd had the TV experience, I had the speaking experience, and I'd been doing one-on-one nutrition coaching. So basically it took all my skills, right, and put them into one. And so I was in the right place at the right time. And I just didn't think about it. I just went in there. It was interesting because it was the first time they'd done that. And really people hadn't been doing anything like this on TV. And so they didn't know what they were doing, and which was shocking to me. They had a personal trainer there. His name was Robert. He didn't know any nutrition at the time. I got him to go to nutrition school. But he didn't know any nutrition. And I'm watching this whole thing, and they didn't even have like a scale. Like, yeah. I'm like, this is, you know, I brought in a body fat scale. I had a $5,000 body fat scale in my car. So that was helpful. I had all this stuff because I've been doing this, right? Yeah. So I just walked in and started doing what I do. And I became an integral part of the show.
I only have you for a few more minutes. So I really want to talk about two things. One, I think that the, you know, being a dad of four, I can't even get my head around the potential possibility of my child dying.
No, right? Don't even wrap your head around it. Like, I don't even want to ever think of that because I don't want to do anything to make it even potentially a potential.
So can we talk about it a little bit? I know that's probably a little bit uncomfortable, but you do share a little bit of it.
Oh, no, it's not uncomfortable at all. I don't, by the way, put it into my brain that that's even a, like, yeah. I had to the night it happened, because the night it happened, I was trying to get very clear on what was best for my son. Mm-hmm. But like, I am absolutely built on like, how do I help both my kids live their ultimate best life? So when my son was hit by the car, he was airlifted.
15?
To
our, he was 15.
He was 16. 16. He was 16. Okay. I had my 15-year-old and my 16-year-old. He was hit by a car. The only reason we found out was my other son and my ex-husband were driving on that same street, which was a couple blocks from our house. I knew my son had gone out walking, and they saw this whole scene. They knew he was out walking. They asked the paramedic, who then said, well, you know, a kid was hit and he looks just like him, you know, pointing to my other son.
Oh, Jesus.
And so, yeah, otherwise he would have been a John Doe and he would have died.
Wow.
So we rushed to the local hospital where we're told that he's got a torn aorta, which kills, by the way, 90% of the people right on the scene. And he's got multiple brain bleeds and 13 fractures. He literally had bones sticking through his skin. It was half his body's road rash. He's got bones sticking through his skin. It was an unbelievable sight. It was surreal. And they said he has to have this aorta repaired. Otherwise, it's going to rupture sometime in the next 24 hours. Each hour, his chance of it rupturing goes up some exponential thing, right? And they go, but we can't do it here because we don't know how to do. There's a special surgery we don't do here without a blood thinner. His brain would bleed out. You'd have his heart or his brain, not both. So they're explaining, you know, he'd never survive this airlift. So, you know, even if he survived it, he wouldn't survive the surgery. And even if he survived both, he'd be so brain damaged, it wouldn't be worth it. So you just need to let him go. My 15-year-old, who's a math guy, looks at this doctor and says, so maybe like a 0.25% chance he could make it. And the doctor says, that sounds about right. He goes, well, we'll take those odds. You know, we were doing a TV show, and because we've done a lot of TV on this, and he looked at me and goes, well, I just knew that that wasn't zero, right? You know, 50% of 20.25% ain't zero. And so we basically overrode this doctor, who was very angry at us, you know, for doing it. He was like very pissed. You should have read this report of, I told them not to do this, that he was going to die on the way. I'm like, he's going to die here. We're overruling you. And then I will tell you, I went outside and I checked in. I just got really quiet because I've always been able to hear my son, and I just wanted to know, was this what he wanted? I mean, like, what if I did this and rescued a vegetable? What if I doomed him to horrible life? And, you know, ultimately as a parent, you need to do what's best for your kid, not what's best for you. So I just stood out there. I'm like, what do I do here? And I got to tell you, I had this hit so strong. It was like fight for him. And I was like, and like from that moment I turned in, it was like Warrior Mom came out and I went, you know, we're overruling you. You need to get on this. And from that point forward, I remember it was like, he's going to be 110%. I would tell him, you know, Grant, your name means warrior. You are going to be 110%, but I need you to fight. I need you to fight for this. So that's what we've done. And honestly, he, in a lot of ways, is much better than he was before that accident. And
so I would imagine based on that, so two thoughts came to my mind. One, even though he's your ex-husband, he sounds like a pretty good guy.
He's fantastic.
You know, like super supportive. You just could hear it. You know, sometimes people just aren't meant to be, but it doesn't mean that they're bad people.
It's just not a fit. But honestly, my son is thriving today. Because we're the perfect partnership to pull this off, because he's super duper patient and will be there and do the heavy lifting. I'm like the firestorm running through, engaging everybody, you know.
I feel like tornado might be better.
Tornado is a good one, you know, but, and so we, you know, I'd blow through and then he'd have to come through and kind of pick up some of the pieces of what, you know, stuff everywhere. So it's been a great match.
How old is your son now?
He's 21.
He's 21. And so does he still have repercussions, it sounds like?
Oh, yeah. I mean, he, you know, he has rods in his femurs. He has a traumatic brain injury. Like he was literally had to learn everything over again. He had to start all over again. So there's been a lot to come to get over. But, you know, he is a nicer person, more empathetic, kind. I mean, there's been amazing gifts from all of this too. And you can focus on what you lose or you can focus on what you gain, right?
I feel like one's better for you than the other, to be honest
with you. Yeah, I know. Which shall I choose?
So how is this, two more questions, three more. How did this impact you? Because I feel like you have this, either I got to fucking go now and make this happen. I feel like that's one of your default modes, you know, because you're this strong, successful, powerful, knowledgeable woman and you need to make shit happen. But there had to be another level of this that impacted you as well. And those were all compliments, by the way.
Thank you. it's interesting. You know, we were sitting around the table talking, my ex-husband and Bryce and Grant, and we all agreed how much better we were because of this. Mm-hmm. It has been the most transformative experience in my life. There really isn't much you could throw at me now that's going to rattle me in any way, shape, or form. I'm amazed at, you know, you hear the don't sweat the small stuff. It's all small stuff. When you go through something like this, you realize how true that really is.
I could ask you 100 questions, but I just have two more. What's next for JJ? Where are you going? What road are you on? You know, you just had a book come out, Miracle Mindset, in 2017. So Are you still out? We didn't even get to that, but, you know, are you still beating the path of that from a promotion standpoint? Are you working on your next big project? Like, what's next?
Yeah, I'm building a whole movement around it that's going to come out next year, really about this whole concept of being a warrior mom. Mm-hmm. Because what I really want to get out into the world is, I think moms tend to put themselves last on their list if they even make the list. Mm-hmm. And that in order to really be that role model for your family and in your life, and I think women are really the big change agents out there in the world. But in order to do that, we have to put ourselves first. And it's not selfish to do that. It's selfless to do that. So I'm really trying to open up that conversation so that women won't feel guilty or bad about taking time for themselves, taking care of themselves, because when they're happy and feeling fulfilled, you'll have happier and more fulfilled kids and you can accomplish more out in the world. So that's the big one that I'm starting to do a lot more bigger stage speaking on, and getting out there.
Mm-hmm. That's definitely super important to me. Sorry. That's totally my wife's philosophy. So she takes total care of herself. Sometimes as the husband, I feel it's selfish, but I understand the reasoning behind it. So, you know, it's one of the dichotomies of relationships. Okay. So last thing, cause you've been awesome with your time. Last little bit here. I asked this of everybody and I love the answers I get. So I'm looking forward to your answers. How do you, JJ, define happiness for where you're at in your life?
Happiness. You know, for me, what's really happened, and it might be because I'm adopted, but I am really close connections are so critical for me. I've kind of created my own family. And so that having really good connections and actually physically seeing people as opposed to having your internet friends is probably where I get the most happiness.
That's awesome. Well, JJ, thank you for your time, your energy, your willingness to sit down with me on Executive After Hours. I've appreciated every minute, and I could talk to you for another hour because I have 1,000 more questions for you.
I know. It's been awesome. Thank you. Sounds like you have a great wife, too, by the way.
Thank you. She's pretty special because she's married to me, which is a challenge in and of itself. So.